having all the support and the energy that we can feel in the community here has definitely given us what we need to pick up speed as we head into Vancouver.
Two Alaskans will be heading to the Olympics next month as part of the U.S. cross-country ski team. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 19th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, as the Alaska legislature gets to work, lawmakers look to saving for the future.
We have to make sure our savings stretch not till past 2020, which I think we're getting very close to being able to do.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Two Alaskans were named to the 8-member U.S. Olympic cross-country ski team today. Keegan Randall and James Southam will be heading to Vancouver next month. This will be the third time Randall takes part in the Olympic Games. She was the first American woman to win a world championship silver medal in the freestyle sprint last year. She's also the first woman to win a World Cup race. Southam is competing in his second Olympics. He recently won his 5th national title at the U.S. National Ski Championships in Anchorage. The two competitors train with the Alaska Pacific University cross-country team. Coach Eric Flora says when he took over the team 4 years ago, he had two goals. One was being the fittest athletes, and the second was to turn that into ski-specific fitness.
What that meant was that for 4 years, we've been training for 11 months out of the year, twice a day. We've skied every month for those 11 months, and we've kind of established ourselves as some of the fittest and the best technical skiers in the world at this point.
With a near constant smile, Keegan Randall said it was an honor for them to be able to represent the United States and Alaska in the upcoming Olympics.
So it was pretty exciting to get the news today that we will be joining the team in Vancouver. For both of us, we've been working really hard, not just for the last 4 years, but probably well over a decade to get to this point. We've really been looking forward to 2010 specifically, to show up at the Olympics, not just as participants, but as real contenders. And I have to say, for me, going into my third Olympics, I'm pretty excited to go in with high expectations for some top results, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun.
James Southam says when he got the call today, he was excited and also a bit relieved.
I hadn't pre-qualified like Keegan had, so it was kind of a little more uncertainty there. And like she said, we've been training together on the same team since, I think she was 15 or 16 or something, and I don't know, I was probably 19. So we've been working together a long time, and this is sort of coming to be the culmination of a lot of years of hard work. You know, like I told the national team coaches at the end of the last Olympics, you know, this one was experience and the next one's for real. And I think for both of us, we're going in with some high expectations and looking forward to some good things.
Southam says the bulk of the work is done and they're now in the final prep phase.
Really, this week we're training really hard, training quite a lot and training specifically for the events that we're looking at in Vancouver. And then, once this week's over, kind of rest up a little bit, travel down to Canmore and get ready for those World Cups there before we head over to the games.
Randall says the geographic proximity of the upcoming Olympic competition offers them a unique opportunity.
Vancouver is practically our backyard, so it's been a wonderful chance to stay here in Anchorage, actually, during the winter. It's been fabulous training conditions, and really just sleeping in our own beds and having all the support and the energy that we can feel in the community here has definitely given us what we need to pick up speed as we head into Vancouver.
James Southam will be focused on the 30K pursuit, a combination of skate and classic techniques, and the 50K classic. He says he'll probably also compete in the 15K and the relay. Keegan Randall says her biggest focus will be on the individual classic sprint and the team sprint.
But I look forward to kind of picking up speed with the opening race, the 10K. And if I'm still feeling good, or hit the women's relay, I'm excited about that. And if I'm still feeling good near the end, I'd love to jump in the 30K.
The 2010 team is smaller than in the past because of a new Olympic quota system. Another APU hopeful, Holly Brooks, didn't make the cut. The team will arrive in Vancouver on February 9th for a schedule that includes 12 medal events. The first of the 90 days allowed for this year's legislative session passed quietly, mostly with ceremony and formalities that have to be dealt with. Presiding officers read new legislation into the record and made committee reassignments as members prepared for a reception this evening at the governor's house. Lawmakers had their first look at their own staff's analysis of the budget that Governor Parnell proposed last month. The 168-page report points to $10 billion in readily available cash held in reserve right now, and it highlights expected revenue surpluses for this current year and next year. However, the report also points to concerns about the long-term future, particularly declines in oil production, volatile prices, and uncertainty of the development of a gas line. The bottom line is the often stated fear that current budget expenditures may not be sustainable. House Speaker Mike Chenault said this morning that he expects a serious effort to control spending.
We're probably the envy of most other states in the nation, but we also know that if oil was to drop to $40 a barrel, it wouldn't take but probably a year or two before we would be in the position where we had no money in the account again, and you know, we might be looking at taxes or some other form of revenue to keep the government going. So there is concern there, and so the dollars that we save, whether they be in capital or whether they be in operating, certainly those are real dollars, and we need to be accountable for them.
The Senate is working toward the same goal. Finance co-chair Bert Stedman says lawmakers saved money last year, even after oil prices dropped from record highs. Part of that was due to excluding from the budget most capital projects that provide infrastructure for local communities. This year, he says, the capital budget is back, but so is a desire to save.
Two areas that we have, or I have concerns on, is the growth in the operating account, which is different from the capital budget. That's your agency growth. And the reduction in volume down the Trans-Alaska pipeline, which generates our revenue. The capital budget around the state can go extremely high to very, very low on the whim of the legislature. And we'll respond in strong revenue years. We should have strong capital budgets. In weak revenue years, we should have very minuscule capital budgets, because we have to make sure our savings stretch until past 2020. Which I think we're getting very close to being able to do.
Committee meetings will begin tomorrow, and Governor Parnell will present his view of priorities with his State of the State speech to a joint session tomorrow evening. From Seward through Anchorage to Fairbanks and beyond, the Alaska Railroad has about 30 capital improvement projects scheduled for 2010. This week, the railroad begins a series of four open house meetings describing those projects and collecting public opinion. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The Alaska Railroad 2010 list includes projects at various stages and ranging in size. They stretch along the railroad's 500-plus miles. Actually, according to the railroad's corporate communications officer, Stephanie Wheeler, one project east of Fairbanks takes place beyond the current lines. It's called the Northern Rail Extension.
That extension would put the rail from North Pole down to Delta Junction. The first phase is a bridge over the Tanana River there at Salsha, and we do have money for about two-thirds of that project. So we've completed the environmental impact statement. We're ready to go on phase one. Phase two would bring the rail from North Pole to Salsha, and I think that the project would probably go in three or four phases after that.
In the Fairbanks area, the railroad will improve the freight area, put a second track by the passenger depot, and realign and improve the safety of some mainline and branch track, including from the depot to Eielson Air Force Base. To the south in Denali Park, the railroad will pursue the development of a passenger turnaround track. That project would enable trains from Anchorage to return from the park rather than having to proceed on to Fairbanks before turning back. Wheeler says one of the first steps in that project is to arrange a land swap between the park and the railroad for the approximate 24 acres needed. Another project in the early stages involves a partnership between the Mat-Su Borough and the railroad.
The Port McKenzie Rail Extension is still undergoing the environmental impact study by the Surface Transportation Board, and that study is considering three major routes that would take a rail extension from the port, either to Big Lake, to Houston, or to Willow, and those are the ones that are under consideration in the study. So we expect that to be complete this year, and once that happens, if we can get some funding, we can pursue design and eventual construction.
The railroad also plans to upgrade its 2001 study for commuter rail service between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Valley. Wheeler describes two of several projects taking place in Anchorage.
Our two big projects here in Anchorage, one is the Ship Creek Intermodal Transportation Center. We got started on that over the last few years on phase one, which is the tracks and the utility work. This year, we're getting started on phase two thanks to some stimulus funding. We'll be doing some enhancements to the historic depot itself. Right next door to the depot, we're still working on actually finishing up on the historic freight shed.
Other projects are set for Nenana, Talkeetna, Wasilla, the Chugach National Forest, Seward, Whittier, and various bridge renovations along the line, including Hurricane Gulch. Wheeler says these projects represent quite a capital investment.
We've got about $43.1 million in new spending for capital projects this year. That doesn't mean that that's the only money that's being spent. Sometimes money carries forward from prior years, but this is new spending. And about $14 million is coming from federal agencies, federal grants. We're spending about $19 million of our own money that we get from generating revenues from freight and passenger and real estate. And then we've got about another $10 million that has come from the sale of revenue bonds.
The Anchorage Open House on the 2010 Alaska Railroad projects takes place tomorrow from 4 to 6:30 in the Anchorage Historic Depot. That's followed by a second open house Thursday in Wasilla at Evangelo's Restaurant, also from 4 to 6:30. The Fairbanks meeting is scheduled for next Tuesday at its depot, and the Seward gathering is February 19th. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans working in Haiti.
I was really surprised. People I've talked to are just very happy to see us and are still optimistic.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Four C-17 aircraft left from Elmendorf Air Force Base this morning, heading for Charleston Air Force Base, to assist in the military's Haitian relief effort. Elmendorf aircraft and crew will rotate into Haiti from the Charleston base. Crew members are active duty and Air National Guard members. Former KCHU Valdez reporter Amy Bracken is in Haiti and reporting for U.S. news outlets. Bracken is in a community in the hills above Port-au-Prince. She says since arriving on Saturday, she's seen improvements in the relief effort, but also some worsening conditions. She says as more aid arrives, doctors and others are getting a bit more organized, and she cites other good signs.
I'm actually standing at a restaurant right now where the owners just cooked a whole ton of rice and sauce and hot dogs and brought them out to feed people at a encampment that's right next door to them, a sort of tent camp in a park. Business is starting to open, too. Apparently, a couple of grocery stores opened. There are people selling fruits and vegetables on the roadside.
Amy, there's numerous reports of chaos and looting. How accurate are those accounts, and do you feel safe where you are?
I have felt completely safe the whole time that I've been here. I think that it's understandable to be concerned about looting and violence, but I get the sense that these reports are overblown. I talked to a UN spokesperson yesterday, and he said that his sources at the UN hadn't gotten any reports of violent incidents. When I go around and interview people, if I'm at food distributions, people normally tell me they're not concerned about security. There was one person I talked to who said he was concerned about Haitian police beating people. Sort of, sometimes there's an overreaction to crowds, and crowds will sort of press in, or even just lines will sort of press in, and people will get anxious to get their food, especially if they've been waiting all day, and sometimes the, you know, police will shoot into the air. I think these certain things are inevitable. And as far as the looting, I think people, in a lot of circumstances, the way that they're living, people would be crazy not to see what they can get from a grocery store.
Someone that I spoke to recently who was in the country before this tragedy said that Haitians are well-versed at helping each other and helping to take care of each other and make sure that they get what they need. Is that sort of what you're seeing there, that there's not so much crime against each other as people helping each other?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, first of all, Haitians are some of the toughest, most resilient people in the world because of all the terrible stuff that's happened in this country. But I've been really moved by how much people are trying to help each other. I went by a university downtown, a state university, and all the students were outside just trying to get organized and figure out, okay, who's studying engineering, who's studying psychology, how can we get everybody together, try to get on the radio airwaves that are still functioning and communicate with each other and get with the government and come up with a plan.
There was a report today, Amy, that the U.S. military has agreed to give humanitarian deliveries priority over military flights at the airport that is being run by U.S. forces. What's been the reaction to this taking this number of days to come about?
Well, people were completely outraged when there was the sort of blockage at the airport and planes weren't getting in, and also that there were some of the stuff that was getting in was just sitting on the tarmac because there was just a lack of organization. Haiti has had so many natural disasters, and after each natural disaster, there are all these declarations by the Haitian government and the international community, we're going to get really organized about this and make sure that this delay in getting aid out doesn't happen again. So I think people have just been sort of amazed that that this would happen again, and that people in the most desperate hours after the storms weren't being helped in the way they needed to.
What are your thoughts generally about the effectiveness of the response from world organizations? How effective is it on the ground there in the communities from your perspective? What and where are the holes?
Well, I think the delay was terrible. I think it's gotten better, and people are definitely feeling that it's gotten better. But there's no sense of hope for getting their lives back. I mean, there are so many people who are just living on the streets. And I think that the people who have been hearing the news are really touched by how much money has been pledged and has been flowing in. I think that's giving people a greater sense of hope. But I think one really, really serious problem is ongoing medical problems, infected wounds, and many, many, many amputations. In a country where it's extremely difficult to have any kind of handicap getting around. So there's an urgent need for the international community, for that reason and for many others, just to maintain that kind of outpouring of support and to realize that everybody's going to need to come together to try to help build Haiti to a much better state than it ever was before.
Amy Bracken is a former APRN reporter who was based at KCHU in Valdez and is now in Haiti. One of the Alaskans in Haiti right now is U.S. Air Force Captain Steve Wachowski. He grew up in Anchorage and now lives in Washington, D.C., where he works at the Pentagon. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, Wachowski and his team are using skills learned in the war zone to help get aid to Haitians.
Wachowski is part of a four-man team from the Pentagon deployed to use full-motion video kits called Rovers. From the ground, they can pull down unclassified images from any overhead airplane with a camera so they can get a bird's-eye view of their surroundings. That, says Wachowski, allows them to monitor and protect the sites where aid and medical care are given.
So we're using that video to help provide security overwatch to aid distribution sites. The key is, at least the military, we're trying to provide security so the UN can distribute food, water, and medicine.
From the roof of the U.S. Embassy, Wachowski could see parts of the city that were flattened, buildings crushed with their concrete crumbled. He looked down at what was once a warehouse, a car dealership, and stores, now piles of broken glass and bricks. Wachowski could also see a soccer field near the U.S. Embassy where casualties are being evacuated to U.S. ships docked nearby that are providing medical care, and he could see hundreds of people gathered around the U.S. Embassy desperately hoping for a way out.
And I mean, these people are camped out in front of the embassy, and there's some in kind of a temporary holding area, and all they want to do is get to the U.S., and some of these people have lost everything.
Wachowski says he hasn't seen any rioting or looting and has been well-received by the Haitians he's met.
I was really surprised. People I've talked to are just very happy to see us and are still optimistic. And they're pretty religious people. This country is about 80% Roman Catholic. And so you see a lot of people just say, thank God you're here.
Wachowski says Americans may see media images of mostly Haitian men surrounding the aid distribution sites, but he says oftentimes the men bring home supplies to their families. One of the military's jobs is to try to make it easier for relief groups and the UN to fairly distribute food and water.
One thing I've noticed, it's a lot of young males, and you don't see a lot of women and children coming to the aid distribution sites, so you want to make sure you get everyone gets their fair share and no one hoards it. But we're, I think, as military, and in my experience doing humanitarian aid drops, I mean, that's fairly normal.
With that, Captain Wachowski had to go. It was time to leave the embassy and head to the UN headquarters to set up a video monitoring kit there. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Juno's Heritage Coffee Company will donate part of the proceeds from every bag of a new premium Haitian coffee to relief efforts in that earthquake-stricken country. Heritage Vice President Travis Smith says for years, one of the company's most popular coffees was Haitian Blue. That particular brand is no longer available, but Smith says the new Haitian coffee should arrive in Juno in about a week and be available for sale or shipment soon. It will sell as Haitian Blue Pine Forest, and Smith says Heritage will give $7 from every bag sold to earthquake relief funds in Haiti.
It's sort of a twofold return to the people of Haiti because you're also buying a product of theirs. So not only are we supporting the relief effort, we're supporting, you know, their base income levels as well for what could be hundreds of farmers.
Smith says the initial supply should yield about 800 bags of Haitian Blue Pine Forest, which could raise more than $5,000 for earthquake relief.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The Alaska National Guard is out with an accounting of rescues. The Guard reports saving 48 people last year and assisting another 12 to safety. Guard spokesman Major Guy Hayes says most of the calls involve medevacs or rescued stranded hunters, snow machiners, hikers, and pilots. Hayes says the 2009 data is just the latest in a National Guard search and rescue mission that traces back 16 years.
Since 1994, we've saved over 1,700 lives and had 720 assists.
The Alaska National Guard has flown more than 19,000 hours and logged over 1,700 saves as well as 720 assists since it began supporting Alaska Rescue Coordination Center calls in 1994. Hayes says the Guard's responsibilities have increased since the Fort Wainwright-based Military Assistance to Safety and Traffic, or MAST, program at Fort Wainwright ended in 2008.
We stayed very, very busy because of that. You know, MAST performed a service that is no longer there, and so we've performed more medevacs, I think, over the last couple of years. We had medevacs going to different locations in the interior, and it's definitely probably increase the work that our rescue squadrons do out of Fairbanks and the Alaska Army National Guard and some of the rural communities.
Hayes says the Guard and other response agencies like the Civil Air Patrol have picked up the average of 2 calls per week that the MAST unit used to handle. He says the Alaska National Guard bases a search and rescue helicopter unit at Eielson Air Force Base Monday through Friday to support interior region missions. The Fairbanks Borough Assembly unanimously approved an agreement with the state that gives the borough responsibility for developing measures to combat fine particulate pollution. The Memorandum of Understanding with the Department of Environmental Conservation contains no specific measures to reduce the output of particulates from combustion of wood and other fuels, but Assemblyman Tim Beck says it lays the groundwork for their development.
This is the beginning of the process. It's certainly not the end. And this does exactly what the voters in their advisory vote asked us to do, which was step up the plate and take the lead role and help develop the processes where we help clean up our own air.
Last fall, voters elected to have the borough take the lead role in managing local fine particulate pollution. The MOU is the first step in coming up with a plan to meet a federal pollution standard the borough currently violates on a regular basis during the winter months when cold air inversions trap particulates from combustion at ground level. Borough Transportation Director Glenn Miller says the initial focus is on better identifying and quantifying the sources of fine particulates.
But we do understand that wood smoke is a significant contributor. So one of the things that we have talked about and we would like to implement is some type of a voluntary measure that allows individuals to change out older type of wood stoves with more efficient type of stoves.
Miller says the borough has $250,000 in federal money to help fund the voluntary buyout and that property tax credits could also be offered. Borough mitigation measures will be part of an implementation plan the state has to file with the Environmental Protection Agency by 2012. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Communication Systems, keeping Alaska connected with solutions for small businesses that manage your company's voice and data systems so you can focus on running your business. ACSAlaska.com. When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.